This is the Serrano Brothers Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Today we have the Reverend Dr. Gabriella Schroeder. Welcome, Gabby. How's it going?
Very well, except that I just told you I'm not a morning person, but I have my trusted cup of strong Italian coffee with me.
Praise God. Gabby, you are the pastor over at Advent Lutheran Church in Citrus Heights, and you're part of the Capital Conference, and you're the dean of the Capital Conference.
I'm the dean of the Capital Valley Conference. That's a conference that stretches from Fairfield down south to Woodland, all the way over to Roseville, Elk Grove, and then, yeah, Citrus Heights included. It's a really neat conference. We are where the political action happens. We have LOPP on our territory, and that we have Lutheran Social Services here. It's really cool to be here.
Oh, that's awesome. So we like to get to know you a little bit better. Tell us about yourself. Where are you from? What does your family look like? That kind of stuff.
Okay. So the ad accent, I think, gives me away. Sometimes people think it's a British accent, which makes me crack up. Yeah, it's 100% German. So I grew up in West Berlin, came to the US in 1990 through kind of the assistance of a senior rabbi in San Francisco, whom I had met in Berlin, and who was on the board of the GTU. So he told me about the GTU after theological studies in Germany, Israel. I came here and to do doctoral work in church history. I thought Christian Jewish studies, and thought I stayed 3 years. That's about how much funding I maybe had. Yeah. And I'm still here. I met while in graduate school my husband. I stayed at PSR. And at that time, there were all these tables in the dining room. You had international students, a table, kind of people would cluster. You had our LGBTQ table. You had the, what I call the disgruntled divorced woman who went to seminary. And so Kumar is from India, was a Lutheran pastor in South India in Andhra Evangelical Lutheran Church, and on a World Council of Churches scholarship here. So for 1 year to study with C.S. Song, who was then at PSR, and I think we hit it off. So we have two daughters, and in just a few weeks, we won't have a kid in college anymore. We had one graduate last fall. We will have one graduate on Memorial Weekend from St. Olaf. And they are two daughters, Naomi and Anna, and they are a joy. They bring life into our home. They keep us young and challenge us in ever so many ways. Yeah, it's really cool. We also have, let's see, who's in the family? We have two dogs, four chickens, sadly no bees right now. And all of our relatives are out of the country. We have now a niece and a nephew in the country, but other places. So Kumar is one of eight, and they are all back in India or have passed away. I'm an only child.
So you grew up in West Berlin, so you remember the wall.
Oh, I do. That was a permanent reality when I grew up here. So we wouldn't go to the other side via Checkpoint Charlie as Americans, but we would have other checkpoints. And we did go sometimes on field trips, both in my high school and during university studies. They have fantastic museums on the eastern side, and our Old Testament professor would have us read old Hebrew script on old museum artifacts and stuff like that. Yeah, so. Yeah, I also remember Both my parents grew up in the East and came. My mom came a little over 2 weeks before the fall of the before the Berlin Wall was built. She managed to switch to the West, so we had family friends there and would go. It was a big to-do thing. You would have to apply, get an approval, then your car would be taken apart at the border. Seats out, and all sorts of things that you're not hiding people. And I remember how they confiscated my capitalist propaganda as kid. Lassie books. Lassie.
Whoa.
They
Oh,
gave them
wow.
back. But anyway, and most likely we're constantly being spied on. Family members, friends, we're all kind of informants for the Stasi. So, yeah. Each time you wanted to go and breathe a little freer, sort of you would hop on a train or drive on prescribed transit routes and go to the west. It took about 2.5 hours to go to Hamburg. That was the closest. Yeah.
Have
So,
you
and
been back since the wall fell?
yes, actually, I left in August 1990. The wall fell in 89 in November.
Okay.
And common currency happened in, I think, July 1990, and the reunification in October. So I got to dance on top of the wall at the Brandenburg Gate. It was
Wow.
very fortified there, very wide. And I was on my way back from a library bag of books, and there were already a lot of people up there and dilapidated ladders. And so people helped me up, shoved me up. Some people pulled from above. And then we stood there and said hi to the soldiers, the East German soldiers on the other side. People threw roses down. There, for 2 weeks, it was magic. It was people drinking champagne on the streets. Lots and lots of people, 500,000 additional people each day, just looking around at colors and lights and. They got 100 marks, then German mark, as welcome gift. And how can we spend that? Yeah, not just buy crap. And then Berliners are a little bit like kind of then Germany's New Yorkers. They make it hurt when they don't like something. They're pretty direct in your face. And they started to be mad at the lines. It took a while to get onto the subway, into stores, and all of that. But it was a good time, and it was a time of hoping of for a third way that never
Yeah.
happened. Yeah, so it was a good time, and
That's amazing.
I have been back. The last time, I don't have family there anymore. So the last time was with my older daughter for 2 weeks in Berlin. We rented an apartment, walked a lot, did a lot of public transportation, and it was really good to show her where I went to school, what is it, what has shaped me. Yeah, introduced her to fantastic Turkish food. Germany, when I grew up, had 10% per Turkish population, and there is this kind of the Turkish equivalent to a shawarma and döner kebab, and it's to die for. I have only found something almost as good in Santa Cruz, but one time. Yeah.
It's amazing how like you're talking about Turkish food in Germany. Here in California, I can't find Mexican food that I like outside of San Diego. You know,
That's how it's
like,
with me. Yeah. Yeah.
that. How do you think that? I mean, as you, I'm sure, have reflected on growing up, looking at a wall. You know, how has that like informed your life? How like is there anything that, I don't know. Just surely that has had an impact on you.
I love to travel. Weeks at a time, staying at one place, exploring it. Just the idea of, I mean, even though we were surrounded by a wall, we were not the ones that were trapped. We had the means to leave. So I'm not the poor victim here. It's the people that couldn't get out, that were in this fake reality on the other side and had no freedoms and were spied on and so. But I love to drive. I never had that sense of driving kind of forever and ever. I only learned to drive a car here. Yeah. So I never needed one in Berlin. There was public transportation round the clock available, basically. So I look at other walls with kind of comparison, maybe recognition, but also, wow, how is this different from mine? How is this similar or so? Yeah. Yeah. So, but it was a good city to grow up. West Berlin was a haven for artists. Rents were dead cheap, especially in less desirable areas. So you could rent parts of older factory buildings. It was significant immigrant population and people who wanted to avoid the West German draft also went to West Berlin. So it was an interesting mix of people. Had a grittiness to it that you didn't find in very clean, neat other German cities. And I like that about it. Yeah.
Did you grow up going to church in Germany? Was your family
Yes and
growing up
no.
Christian?
So my mother grew up, as I said, in the East, and her aunties, her mom died when she was 15. Her mother and her aunties went to church. For them, that was an element of resistance, an act of resistance. This is where things were real, kind of where you didn't have to lie and pretend something that wasn't there. When she went to the West, when she conceived me, raised me, and so church was there for her. She was a single mom, but it had lost that act of resistance part. So, but I went to attended kids choir, Sunday school. I went through confirmation class. So I did go to church, and church was actually. In high school, my history teacher was friend with a pastor, and that pastor was part of a team who organized a trip to Poland in 1980. And 1980, Poland was the time of the Solidarity Movement. It started in August. So while we wanted to go there, visit sites of former concentration camps, the Warsaw Ghetto, meet with union leaders, ecumenical leaders, survivors of concentration camps, our trip changed quite a bit. Lots of things were canceled, but that's that trip. In my very last kind of semester of school was what made me study theology. And we didn't have the distinction in Germany then between undergraduate and graduate studies. So you graduate from high school, you decide basically what you want to do for the rest of your life. The tender age of 18 or 19, yeah. So I in Poland we found evidence of the utter atrocities that religion had inspired, the anti-Judaism that had fueled Nazism and its racism. But we also found traditional Catholicism that fueled the resistance against the communist regime. So I had just lots of questions. What is this religion thing? Yeah, and I didn't start studying theology with a big kind of conversion moment or anything or a strong call, just was curiosity and questions. So, and in a way, the call has gone stronger, but I'm still prone to asking questions. And sometimes it gets on my family's nerves. Yeah.
No,
So.
I think that's great. I think that I think we should hear more stories of pastors it starts off as curiosity, right? And it turns into call, because it's not like this big evangelical in the American sense kind of conversion experience. And oh, you know,
Exactly.
sometimes it's you kind of grow into this thing, and it becomes the object of your affection, right?
And I find it actually much more solid in a sense. If you start with this big conversion moment and then this encounter critical historical studies in seminary, it can very easily change, and
Oh
you can
yeah.
be so disillusioned. Yeah.
Very
So,
much so. Very much so.
yeah.
That's yeah.
In fact, I think we're seeing that a lot in with this kind of deconstruction movement in the evangelical church, where I mean, there's all kinds of people who are learning critical historical methods of reading scripture, and they are deconstructing their faith, and lots of them are kind of deconstructing it out of the faith instead of kind of the early emergent church, which was always still within the faith.
So is that kind of your background, more the w how did you grow up?
Yeah, we both grew up Catholic, and then we both kind of had I don't like to say conversion experience anymore. I like to say intensification of faith. You
That's a good
know,
term,
more towards the end of high school for me. And then I spent, you know, 5 or 6 years in an evangelical charismatic churches. And then I went to seminary and I learned all the things you learn in seminary. And I was like, oh, and I think the big thing for me was learning what the Bible actually is rather than what kind of that inerrant, infallible word that evangelicals are taught. And it was there that I was like, oh, that opened my eyes to things like LGBTQ folks, you know, and changing my mind about that, because I learned that the Bible is not what I thought it was, you know, and it gave me a more expansive view about what that means for the community of God, right? And how it's messier and not as straightforward than the Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it, you know. That
But
kind of.
messy makes for interesting things, yeah?
Absolutely,
Indeed, it
right?
does.
Yeah.
And it's conversation, and it's not it's yeah, and it in every time new generations have new questions, and we have to deal with those things.
So I'm finally going to go on my first youth gathering trip this year. So and I loved unpacking with the kids all those themes for the day, whether it's authentic or brave or free, disruptive. Yeah. So I look forward to this. And being authentic is a big thing. Just even embracing, if you're a smaller church, okay, you're a smaller church. If you're an aging church, you're an aging church. Embrace it and find what makes you strong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So you're talking about your church and embracing what is strong. Is there something that your congregation does that you just love, that you want to tell us about?
Yes, it's indirectly. I am working on the shoulders of somebody kind of who has been the, had been there for 38 years. It has its pluses and its minuses, yeah. But one thing he did really well, and Ray Olson was his name, to co-found a food closet, they called it then. Sunrise Christian Food Ministry. It started out in a small house, kind of the garage. Now it is has its own structure on campus and feeds 150 households each day, 5 days a week from our parking lot. Our parking lot Monday through Friday is busier than on Sunday. And I love that we have that impact on the community. That is, yes, we don't run this. This is its own nonprofit organization. We get a little rent from it, but not, they get so much more. It's really very minor compared to that they basically take over the campus during certain hours of the day. And We feed people, and it's a very Christian ministry. So the volunteers start in the morning with prayer, and they try to channel God's love. It's not always easy. There are abusive people there, impatient people. Why does he get more than I get, or so? Yeah, there are people that take advantage of the system, might re even resell some of the stuff, or so. Yeah, or pretend that their household is bigger. It's not our problem. That's between them and God. So that's what I'm really proud of. And internally, we started 2 years ago wellness ministry, embracing we are an aging congregation, and so what's wrong with it? Let's intentionally serve people in their last third of life, foster community, do fall prevention, classes on prayers, outings, art classes, and it's really going well, and it's a new thing. So they can't compare to, oh, this is the way we've always done it. So, yeah. So
That's really great.
those two things really give me joy.
That's
Yeah.
wonderful.
What else?
So you and I kind of touched bases because you went on a trip, and you went to Israel, Palestine, right? Tell us about that.
Okay. So when you talked about conversion experience or kind of deconstructing charismatic evangelicalism and kind of putting on almost a new set of glasses, that has happened to me during my first call. As I said, I studied in Israel in at Hebrew University for a year. It was in the mid-80s, 85, 86, right the time of Chernobyl. And Talmud, Midrash, Jewish feminist studies, archaeology. It was a terrific year. I spent half of it in a student dorm, half of it in an apartment. And I got to experience a diversity fa firsthand that I didn't quite see in Germany. The Turkish population that I mentioned were then non-citizens. They were guest workers. Yeah, so they were on a supposedly temporary. Yeah? But here suddenly I had lived faith traditions, lived cultures that were so different from my own. My master's thesis on Christian Zionism came out of that. I did some research at Central Zionist Archives later, yeah, and worked as a research assistant in Germany, on kind of on the diaries of Theodor Herzl, the founder of political Zionism. And then, yeah.
Just for people who may not know, what is Christian Zionism? What is Zionism?
Zionism is a movement for the return of the Jewish people to Palestine, to what they consider their homeland. Christian Zionists, for whatever reason, are those who support the return of Jews to their homeland. And they do that for a number of different reasons. One of them has to do with different theologies that we're not quite familiar with in the Lutheran word, dispensationalism. And the idea that there are different ages, and after the age of the church will again come an age of the Jewish people of Israel, and how can we Christians be instrumental and supportive of that? So that's Christian Zionism. There is a religious aspect to it, and there is a political aspect. Zionism was born in a time when all the people of Europe, the Italians and the Greeks and the French and Germans, wanted to have form nation states. And so there were these people at the end of the 19th century said, we want a nation state of our own too. And then they looked around, can we do it in Uganda? No. Sorry, there are others already, and we we don't want to live there, and we have already an organic connection to Palestine. So that's what I was referring to. And the political Zionism was founded by a man called Theodor Herzl, who grew up in Vienna, was born in Hungary, and had something called the First Zionist Congress at the very end of the 19th century. So anyway, and now picture first call in South San Francisco, what was then called our Redeemer's Lutheran. It's part of Unity Lutheran Church right at this point. And I had people in the congregation that were from Bethlehem. I had a family of four siblings that were in their 70s or so and had grown up there. I had an organist who was married to a Palestinian Lebanese violinist and who would play for us on Christmas Eve often. And ELCA had this campaign, Peace Not Walls. And as part of that, in I think 2006 or so, brought a dance group from Ramallah, from the Lutheran Church of Hope in Ramallah, to the U.S. They toured all over the U.S. and I was participating in organizing their Bay Area leg of that tour. We had 15, 16-year-olds, their high school students, Muslims, Christians, that danced then, performed, told stories, sang at four different locations, Walnut Creek, somewhere in Silicon Valley, Oakland, and one other location that escapes me. But we also kind of put together fun programs that they could be kids, really just kids. Mm-hmm. And in preparing for that, I met some really good people that changed my mind. It feels kind of like looking at a reality that I thought was familiar through a different set of glasses. Yeah. So seeing suddenly the other side of the wall, seeing the story of the Palestinians and questioning this myth of a land for a people, that the Jewish people went to an area that wasn't populated. Mm. And is not quite true. So
is that really out there that Palestine wasn't populated?
Wasn't densely populated. It was empty land ready for the taking, kind of, yeah? Mm. And that clashes because it's widely acknowledged that about 750,000 people left in the late 1940s. And the dominant story goes like they left voluntarily because they were duped by surrounding Arab neighbors to leave for 2 weeks and then go back. There were actually... They left in many cases at gunpoint in results of massacres in villages, and so it wasn't quite voluntary. And it's more than 3/4 of the population actually were forced out. So,
and where were they forced to?
They were forced into surrounding areas. A lot of them ended up in Gaza. So the people that are right now in Gaza, escaping from city to city to city, were refugees in the late 40s already. They escaped to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, the West Bank, which was then Jordanian territory. So, and in all those areas, there were refugee camps. A lot of them went also abroad, South, North America, so wherever they had connections.
Help me understand something. So in that region, there were Jews, Muslims, mm-hmm. and Christians living together.
They lived together in a relative harmony. Yeah,
for a long time.
A long time, up to
What
the
ha
2000s,
what
yes.
happened that changed that?
Depends who you ask.
Okay. When
Yeah.
you're from your point of view.
From my point of view, it happened that there is a new concept out there, the idea of settler colonialism. And not everybody embraces it. If you look at literature, it's relatively new that basically European people from Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Jewish people came and settled in an area. And they were in a sense foreign elements. The Jews, the Muslims, the Christians spoke Arabic before or were bilingual. And suddenly you had these people that came and changed things. They bought land. A lot of it was legally acquired. Yeah, some people moved into houses that had been abandoned because people just had sought refuge elsewhere. But it was an outside influence. And in the same way, I mean, settler colonialism is the same type of colonialism that you find in the US. Where a small number of people controls the business in a large area. And land is at the heart of it. Who has ownership of the land? So it's a different type of colonial enterprise, let's say, than in India or so, where you have smaller islands where they don't acquire necessarily land, but try to extract resources. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I think that's helpful. And so you said that your mind was changed, and it was changed through this group of people. How has that affected kind of like you said this was in the 80s that your mind changed.
No, the mind changed in like early 2000s, kind
Early
of
2000,
first
my
calls,
apologies.
for yeah, first call, sort of late 2000s.
So tell us
From what
about
to what? What did your
from
from
seeing only one version of history to seeing another people's version of history and getting one version, the kind that is promoted, let's say, by the Exodus movie or so, yeah, challenged by a different version. There is a dominant historiography and there is another version of history in a way. And I have since listened. Went on to conferences in Israel, Palestine. There are several branches of liberation theology institutes, Lutheran, Anglican, Maronite, which is kind of Eastern Catholic. And I learned a lot from talking to pastors. NGO representatives, lawyers, UN staff. And it just changed me. Just listening to stories changes you. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, we hear about the change, but what was the change? Like,
The
what?
change is that I don't believe in this two-state solution anymore. I see a people that is oppressed, lives in insecurity, gets arrested, fears for their lives, doesn't is deprived of freedom. I see growing numbers of Christians leave the area. Bethlehem used to be a majority Christians town. It's not anymore, yeah. And I just see what it means to be an oppressed people and to live under oppression. That's kind of it. And how should I say this? I am in no way to justify the atrocities committed on October 7th. But I can see how frustration can living in this small area with 2 million people with no ch foreseeable change, how that can people turn how people can turn violent in that context. So I see oppression more as systemic, as long term or so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, yeah.
I think one of the and given my my knowledge of this is just from what I read from other sources, so I don't have firsthand experience with Palestinians or Israelis in this matter. But Thomas Friedman, a guy, he wrote an article saying that Israel should be very careful how it acts after October 7th, and it was October 7th, right? And the reason being was because with the Abraham Accords that happened, they were going to start normalizing relationships with Muslim countries and
Correct.
Israel. And Hamas's goal is for that not to happen, to keep kind of
Right.
Israel outside of relationships. And so they baited Israel to do this.
Could be, yes. I wouldn't rule that out.
Hamas did this attack knowing full well that it was going to be an unproportional response, so that it would get other Arab countries to lose the taste in their mouth of wanting to normalize relationship with Israel. And I find that to be an interesting kind of argument, because what we're talking about also, right, in the wider view is there are groups of people, and there's been since Israel was founded, wars with the intended purpose of saying we don't want Israel around anymore, and in my mind, I don't know the solution. I don't know the solution to this. I don't pretend to know the solution,
Neither do I.
but it seems to me also that one way to look at this is Israel is not the, necessarily the it, I would say I wonder and I don't want I wonder
No, it's okay.
if yes, Israel is the oppressor in one situation, but given the wider region, they are not the oppressors of they are the people who are under attack. You know what I mean? Because if other if I mean it I mean it has been that other countries have been like, our intended goal is for Israel not to be Israel anymore. We'd rather see them gone. And that doesn't happen just by
Asking
exiling
them to
them,
leave.
asking them to leave, right? That comes by also genocide. And
I think
it just seems
you
so complicated to me. And like I all that to say, I don't like I see the oppressor oppressed narrative that you're speaking of, and then I kind of zoom out and I go, okay, does that narrative still fit? And I don't know that it does. In terms of like Israel just being the and I don't want to defend what they're doing right now because I don't think what they're doing is right. I don't in no way want to defend Israel. But I think it's yeah.
I think that shows the complication of it, Josh, because I'm with you in that you can be oppressed and be an oppressor to another group of people. It's not a if you are an oppressed person, that is all you are. You can turn around and still do that to the people down the line.
And you can have gone through a history of trauma,
Right.
Holocaust, and then just as individuals kind of who have gone through personal trauma, you can then inflict that si similar trauma upon others with a
Absolutely.
disproportional response. But when I studied in Israel. There were far fewer Jewish people living there than there are today. There has been significant more immigration from Ethiopia, from Russia, from all sorts of places. There is, basically, if you're Jewish anywhere in the world, you are allowed to be a citizen. Can have dual citizenship if your ancestors have been born, let's say, in Haifa or in the Tel Aviv area, and were forced out. You cannot even go back. You have lost your property. There are over 5 million people that are considered by UN Palestinian refugees. They have no right to return, and that's the question. Why can't this wonderful land be shared? Why does it have to be a state, religiously defined state for one people? Can it not be a democratic, multicultural state for all the people that have ties to this land?
Aren't there, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't there Muslims on that have political power in Israel?
There are Palestinian, there are Arab citizens of Israel. They are also represented in the Knesset, but there's larger population in Nazareth and in other areas, kind of Christians and otherwise Muslims. So they're both Christian and Muslim Arabs in Israel. They have political representation, but in many ways they are second-class citizen when it comes to serving in the military, when it comes to other aspects, when it comes to housing permits, expanding the territory of Nazareth, for instance, adding to it is not a possibility. So there are different sets of rules in a way.
Which, I mean, in the United States, that's the thing we strive for, right? Is for there not to be two separate rules for people, right?
Exactly.
That it's
Yeah.
that we are all equal, that we all have the same
Exactly.
rights, and that's the kind of thing that's our ideal, and it doesn't happen all the
No.
time. It doesn't
No.
happen, but that's the thing that we kind of strive for, you know?
And if you
And
don't even have that ideal, if you define, for instance, the US as a Christian nation, or the state of Israel as a Jewish nation, so that creates a whole bag of new problems. What about the people that don't have that identity?
Right,
Yeah.
right. I think that's a. I think
Yeah.
that's interesting. And so do you. So you recently went to.
I went in late February as part of a relatively ad hoc delegation of 20 plus religious leaders, Christian leaders from around the country. I was the only Lutheran in the group, and I think the only, no, there were three of us from California. And we stayed in Bethlehem at the guest house of Christmas Lutheran Church, and which was in the news a lot about because of the baby and the rubble on Christmas or so. And we list met with people in Bethlehem, in Ramallah, in East Jerusalem, and in Hebron, and asked questions. What is different since October 7th for you? What is the same? How does this war in Gaza affect you? What is your situation on the ground like? We talked to the head of the UNRWA, the United Refugee Assistance Agency, about his work and how that is under threat of coming to an end if they lose their funding. We talked to various Lutheran pastors, lay leaders. We talk to lawyers that work with incarcerated or with children that are detained in Israeli pr Palestinian children detained in Israeli prisons. And it was a good experience. It was hard to listen to this.
So, what were some of the differences between before October 7th and after October 7th?
The audacity of night raids of the Israeli military into Palestinian refugee camps, into villages, the frequency of those night raids where somebody would bang on your door and then pull men and children out of their beds and take them away to be questioned. And there's nothing much you can do at that point. The violence of Israeli settlers being Israeli citizen who built illegally under UN rules in occupied territory, towns, cities, villages, outposts. How they attack Palestinians and try to drive them from their land has increased. Basically, everything is the same, but more. That's kind of the message we got. And then the heartbreak of people who have relatives in Gaza and fear for their safety and try to raise money to somehow smuggle them out via the border to Egypt or so. All those stories.
And were did you find that the people you were interacting with, were they generally supportive of Hamas or not?
No, not one of them. They we predominantly moved in the Christian world, so there is a difference, but they could see how the situation is so hopeless in Gaza that this could boil over, but they were not supportive. We didn't find a single supporter of Hamas there. Not one.
That's
But
good
we
to
all
hear, 'cause the last news that I read was that it was like something like 70% of people in Gaza and 56% of people in the West Bank were supportive of Hamas, so
Yeah, so Hamas, in addition to being a military organization, is also a social service organization. They supply policemen. They have social workers and stuff. Hamas is not just a guerrilla force or a terrorist organization. They also contribute to the social fa fabric of society. So, in a sense, it depends on what questions you ask, if you are supportive of Hamas or are you supportive of violent solutions to it. I think it depends. One has to distinguish what questions are being asked. Hamas is more than a band of armed fighters, armed terrorists, I think. So.
I think that's a really good point. I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, because you can still do good social justice and I mean, Hamas's charter is to remove Israel from the planet.
Yes,
And
and
so we got to acknowledge that, right? Like, but they
totally.
can still have social services for their
Yes,
people.
but Hamas is not the only organization. They don't represent all of Palestinians.
Did you, is there
Yeah.
anything when you were there that particularly moved you, that kind of made you have another moment, like you said, where you're like, wow,
Yeah.
you know.
We met a family that farms a property 4 or 5 miles southwest of Bethlehem, the Nassar family. They are members of Christmas Lutheran Church, And their grandfather has purchased in from during the time of the Ottoman Empire, in kind of around the time of World War I, purchased a farm. That farm, they had documentation for that. They had actually took the time to register their land first with the Ottoman authorities, then once Palestine was governed by the British, even with the British, they have paperwork. And for years and years, they try to hang on to the farm that they own, that is legally theirs, has been in their family. They have grow grapes, have olive trees, fruit trees, all sorts of things. And they are on a hilltop, and there is a ring of hilltops that is now being occupied by Israeli settlements with one Palestinian village in the middle. Their farm is of strategic importance because it would clo allow them to close the ring. And at this same time, that family has managed to have just an attitude of peace, of reconciliation. They hold summer camps for children, yeah, and all the while they go to court, from court to court to court, for now over 3 decades, yeah. And while we were there, while we were listening to their story, there were two armed settlers again with machine guns just trespassing, walking through their land as if it's theirs. Yeah. The farm, they gave their farm the name of Tent of the Nations. Google it. It is very interesting. But just this attitude of steadfastness, of hope that I encountered with Daoud Nasser and his two siblings, his mom, is just blew my mind. Yeah, how he still can believe that the reconciliation is possible, even though, I mean, he has gone through over 3 decades of fighting in courts and proving that the farm is really truly theirs, and that they are actually farming. It is not sitting there just, they lose access road after access road. It's hard. We had to transfer into a smaller bus just for that leg of the trip to go up a steep hill on it. It was scary. Yeah. Yeah. But that is probably the most moving aspect for me, to be invited into this family's home. They are not allowed to add any structures to their own property, to build any houses. So they have caves on their property, which they then build out into meeting spaces. Yeah. It's a really, really beautiful ministry for them.
And I find it just to be so tragic that their family has owned it since the, talk about historical ties. Like, since the Ottoman Empire, they can prove, that this is their family's land. They can prove it. And they're still just being inundated and access being removed. That just seems so tragic and terrible and wrong to me,
I told their story in a sermon to my congregation after I came back with some photos. And so, and the idea of property ownership is something that my congregation could so much resonate. Yeah. If it's something rightfully belongs to you, why do you have to defend it? Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, and as a part of that they still have hope, that they still believe in reconciliation. I got to tell you, when I hear stories like that, it makes me realize how I can have joy and hope in the future amidst the problems that are not even close to that,
Yeah.
you know?
Lately, when you say hope, lately there's a word that is much more meaningful for me even than hope right now, steadfastness. The concept of holding on against all odds, whether in that context or whether in our own cultural and context in the US and how church culture is shifting. And the ELCA, what used to be Peace Not Waltz, about 2 years ago has changed its name. They got to review their own kind of the principles undergirding it all, and it is now known by Sumud. And Sumud is the Arabic word, Sumud, is the Arabic word for steadfastness. And I like that
Yeah,
very much
steadfastness
so.
in the face of
Yeah.
oppression.
Yeah.
Oh, Gabby, we've been going for 55 minutes. We try to keep this to about an hour. One of
Yeah,
the things we
totally.
like to do is to ask a set of 10 questions of all of our guests, and they're meant to be kind of your first thoughts. So no,
Okay, yeah. Don't
are you ready?
overthink.
Don't overthink it.
Jared, before we get into these questions, is there anything else you wanted to
Oh,
tell us
yeah.
about what
No,
we
I'm
okay.
just deeply grateful for this opportunity to spend time with you, and just nice. It's often so hard to be away from the Bay Area and from all the things that happen there. I'm kind of in the boonies here, but and most of my friends were there. Most of my previous work was there. I was pastor in Silicon Valley for some time before going and being ELCA missionary in India, and so. And now that disconnect, it's nice to be
Well,
connected.
and we're, I think I'm just so grateful to hear your experience, because I think kind of on the ground experience from, from you hearing about how you grew up and the walls, and then really resonating with it, the Palestinians and the walls they encounter, just kind of I think that's good for us to reflect on and to and so I appreciate so much
I
you
see
being here.
my ministry. I mean, the different people use different images for their ministry. I see myself as a bridge builder. Not some others may say midwife or whatever. For me, it is building bridges, whether it is between different religion, between secular and religious people, labor movement or so, and faith community or so. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well, it's been wonderful.
Okay.
All right, here's our questions for you.
Okay.
Which food can you eat every day?
Mangoes.
What's your favorite movie genre?
Action.
Salty, sweet, or savory?
Sweet, unfortunately.
In addition to the Bible, what book would you have with you on a deserted island?
Lord have mercy. Too bad there are no cell phone signals. I would want Kindle with me. Don't really know. Sorry, blank.
All right, what fills your cup?
My family.
What depletes your cup?
Feelings of inadequacy, not doing enough.
What's your favorite holy place?
The beach, because the constancy of the waves reminds me how little I am and how small my problems are.
What's one piece of good advice that you've been given?
Stay with it, things get better.
What does rest look like for you?
Gardening.
And on that last day when you enter heaven, what do you hope God will say to you?
Well done, good and faithful servant.
Friends, Gabby, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was a pleasure to have you. Friends, this has been the Reverend Dr. Gabrielle Schroeder. Thanks for listening.
Bye, and thanks for having me.